Break down, 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 down.
An old woman can sit. An old man can sit. A chump can sit. A coward can sit. Anything can sit. Well, you and I have been sitting long enough, and it's time today for us to start doing some standing and some fighting to back that up.
This is Yuri Kochiyama, and I'm listening to Hard Knock Radio.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Today is what would have been the 96th birthday for El Haj Malik Shabazz Malcolm X, as we know him. And, you know, every year we usually take some time out and we do a little something to acknowledge his life, to uplift him, and to make sure that a younger generation understands his significance. It's also the birthday of somebody else who we've talked about on this show, who also shares his birthday as well. And her name is Yuri Kochiyama. We wanted to kind of bring both these landmark figures, these freedom fighters, together and have a conversation, especially in lieu of what's been going on with our Asian brothers and sisters, with all the vitriol and all the hate that has really been heightened and intensified over the past year or so. Joining us to talk about Black and Asian solidarity and to talk about the life of Yuri Kochiyama and Malcolm X are Yuri's grandchildren, Zulu Williams and Akemi Kochiyama. Zulu is a longtime designer, you know, former graph writer, and was one of the people that was behind, if people are old enough to remember, P&B Nation, which was a clothing design. And Akemi is a scholar, educator, and somebody who heads up the Yuri Kochiyama Archives and is over at the Manhattan Country School. So welcome to the show, you guys. And this would have been Yuri's 100th birthday. What should we know about her? And do you feel that her contributions to the struggle, her legacy is something that is kind of erased from the history books? I think many of our listeners know her because of the type of station we are. But do you think, you know, the average person really understands, you know, and knows what she was about?
Thanks for having us, Davey D. Our grandmother, Yuri Kochiyama, I think the thing to know about her, and Akemi could chime in, of course, is just, so she had this sort of this mantra that she coined and she lived by, which was build bridges, not walls. And she really was in solidarity with many movements. She was in solidarity with, the movements in terms of like Puerto Rican liberation and Pan-Africanism. And she was a follower and friend of Malcolm X, of course. This political prisoner, liberation movement, and of course the Asian American movement. But I think what's important to take away is that she really dedicated her life to these struggles, and she lived her mantra to make alliances with people who were marginalized and oppressed people all over the world, and I think that was probably her biggest legacy.
I would just add to that I think that she's really important. I think some people are aware of her, some aren't, but I think what's most important is that she was the sort of opposite of the model minority, idea or stereotype. She was not, an assimilationist. She was not, she was very much in solidarity with people of color, of all people in struggle, of all oppressed people. And very much international in her scope of understanding solidarity, which she would definitely credit Malcolm with providing her with that broader internationalist understanding in terms of anti-imperialism as being the thing to fight against broadly. And I think that that's really critically important. And her story is one of those stories I think you don't hear about in mainstream American, you know, media, society, et cetera, because it is a counter narrative and it doesn't fit that model minority myth. And, you know, I think the powers that be really want to exaggerate the polarization between Black and Asian people for many reasons. And Uri is, you know, is an example of, you know, the opposite of that. And so I think that's why it's really important. Her story right now is really important.
You know, what informed your grandmother's activism? You know, was it, you know, she went to school, saw some things and decided to get involved? Was it, you know, lifetime experiences? You know, what do we need to know about that?
I think she would say herself that, you know, a person's political philosophy evolves over time. It's not something that you just, you know, born with, or it just comes, and it should change over time as you learn more. So I'd say her political philosophy, you know, which really became, you know, sort of eventually radical anti-imperialism, evolved over time. You know, I think when she was a young girl growing up as a second generation Japanese American, you know, kid growing up in San Pedro, California, I think she would have described herself as extremely patriotic, extremely Christian. You know, I think the first probably major thing that happened was the experience of internment. So as a Japanese American citizen, you know, Executive Order 9066 happens, and she and her family and all the Japanese American citizens they know are rounded up and lose all the rights of citizenship. I think she said that experience did not politicize her, but it did make her start to see America differently. At that point. And then there were various experiences happened throughout the war. But really, she would say after the war, it was their experience. My grandfather and her ended up living in public housing all of their lives. And, you know, I've learned more and more that there was a result of my grandfather, you know, even though he was a veteran and fought in the front lines in segregated Japanese troops, like the Black troops, they did not get the benefits of the GI Bill, right? So they didn't get the low interest mortgage rates or the job security or the free, you know, the education they were supposed to get. And so, you know, they ended up, you know, sort of in a situation with, you know, Black, low-income Black and brown families, right, in New York City. And I think that experience, you know, and that just sort of proximity and then that experience, right, also informed them. And you know, I think Uri and my grandfather would say over time, you know, they started to see these similarities. They both ended up during the war passing through Hattiesburg, Mississippi, which is where the segregated Japanese and Black troops trained during, you know, World War II. And it was the first time either one of them had seen Jim Crow. And I think that was, you know, an interesting experience to have in the midst of World War II, while you're being like losing the rights of citizenship and all of a sudden being exposed to institutionalized racism on a level they had never known before that. You know, so I think all of that informed their growing understanding is that people of color in this country experience rights of citizenship differently, and that began to inform them. But absolutely, I would say, Uri would say that meeting Malcolm was her, you know, political, it changed her whole political consciousness and broadened it from civil rights to much to a more broader understanding of international sort of politics.
Right. And appreciate that. Go ahead.
Can I just add one more thing? I think there's also the trauma that both Uri and Malcolm had experienced in terms of what had happened to their fathers. So one of the things that happened to Yuri's father, which I think also set her on a different course, was literally the day that Pearl Harbor was bombed. He had just returned home from the hospital because he was sick. And the FBI knocked on the door. My grandmother opened the door, and they just, you know, they just went in and told her father, you know, asked where he was. She said he was lying down. They went in the bedroom. They whisked him up. They told him to put on a robe, and they took him out. And they didn't even tell her where he was going.
Wow.
When they finally, you know, after making calls and asking around, figured out that he had been taken by the FBI, and then was being interrogated. When he came home, he the next day after he was finally released and came home, he passed away. So I think that
was there foul play going on when that happened?
I think, like I said, probably the interrogations. I think when he came home, he couldn't see.
He couldn't speak either. He couldn't communicate when he came home from interrogation. He was no longer able to communicate. So I can only imagine what happened to him. Yeah. I do know we also heard a story that where they were keeping him, they had a sign around his bed that said prisoner of war.
Wow. You know, that sort of history is something that is, you know, we've kind of heard about internments, but we don't really know about the internment camps and what that meant, you know, for American citizens who were just whisked away. We see all this domestic terror that takes place routinely, you know, here in the U.S., and yet we don't see other populations rounded up and sent away, or, you know, even laws, you know, to kind of hold entire groups of people accountable. But it definitely is a legacy that, as we're starting to know and learn, as we look at AAPI, you know, Heritage Month, that laws were definitely crafted to go after folks who are Japanese, Chinese, or of Asian descent throughout the country. And I think this goes back to your point, Akemi. It doesn't fit the narrative. So when we talk about some of these things in school, we'll just talk about it for one side and then just act like it never happened on the other, until we're like, oh, I didn't know y'all were in segregated troops, which I didn't know until now. You know, I didn't know y'all had, you know, those types of things. I bring all this up because at the top of the show, I was talking about, you know, steps that are being taken to, you know, bring about Black and Asian solidarity. One, is that a presumptuous thing to even put out there? That would be one. And two, what sort of things do we see taking place? And maybe we can start building with the type of friendship that your grandmother had with Malcolm, you know, sharing the same birthdays, but, you know, how that sort of friendship could be modeled, or maybe there were certain things that we take away from it that may be applicable to today. And anybody can hit that.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked the question. There's a lot of different answers to different things you asked. I think in terms of what are the different ways Black and Asian people could be working in solidarity, I think that was part of the beginning part of your sentence. There's a lot going on, contrary to, well, first of all, there's always been a lot going on, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and there still remains a lot going on right now. And we're involved in multiple things that are happening because it's Malcolm's birthday this week, but and Yuri's birthday this week, as well as Ho Chi Minh, as well as Lorraine Hansberry. So we can talk a little bit about things that are happening in different communities to celebrate all of those people. But I want to point to one example that I think is a really good one, because we were talking about internment. So, you know, Executive Order 9066 was issued and basically took away the rights of citizenship for about 120,000 Japanese American citizens, right? Mm-hmm. As the bombs dropped on Pearl Harbor. And we've learned now that it was part of a broader strategy also to disenfranchise Japanese businessmen at that time, who were actually beginning to dominate farming, fishing, like my grandfather, my great grandfather, the fishing industries. And so the moment that happened, they also seized those businesses, all their equipment, their land, wow, et cetera, right? So there was a huge land grab and a huge financial windfall for American, you know, certain American businessmen and farmers and different people on the West Coast. And that was part of the broader economic strategy of the Executive Order 9066, which I think people need to understand, right? Because, you know, America's in the business of disenfranchising people of color. So, you know, I think it's important to understand that that was a part of what happened. Okay, so that, you know, that happens. And so they come back from the war with the shirts on their back, right? Most people lost everything, right? And had to sort of rebuild from that. And Japanese Americans had that experience. And a lot of Japanese Americans didn't talk about this experience for many, many years because of embarrassment, shame, wanting to just reassimilate, you know, different. Well,
let me ask you just a quick question, not to cut you off.
Sure.
When people, when Japanese folks returned from the war or from internment, were they able to get their businesses and properties back, or was just kind of like, okay.
No. So like I said, they were seized. Mostly white businessmen still, you know, seized their all of their property. So they had to start from scratch, complete different disenfranchisement of people. Some people were very successful and owned lots of land and lots of stuff. This was a strategy, a very purposeful one. You know, as my grandmother said, you know, my great grandfather, who was interrogated to death, he was a leading fisherman at the time, a businessman in the community and a community leader. They rounded up all the community leaders and the businessmen first. They got them first, right? So that's an important part of it. But the more importantly is that Japanese Americans had this experience, right? And then came out of the war and many people were able to recover. But like my family, many Japanese American families ended up in low-income Black communities, right? Because of what had happened. And there are many stories I'm learning more and more of Black communities really welcoming those families in, helping those families build back, you know, some kind of economic stability, and many stories of that. And I've seen now many school pictures of Japanese Americans who were in school with all Black students. So you see these public school pictures from Detroit, Chicago, LA, San Francisco of Black and Japanese classrooms, public school, right? So it's very interesting. So this happened right after the war. It's not a story that's really told, but more importantly, what's interesting, so this happens, and then actually Japanese, my grandparents were part of this. My grandfather Bill was one of the big lobbyists, got reparations in the 1980s, and actually were able to get some kind of financial compensation for the people who were still alive who experienced that. So my grandparents were a part of that. I think, you know, in much part that happened because it was a very fixed number of people, 120,000 people. They could find their ancestors. They could come up with a fixed number, write them a check and make this apology, right? So this happened. But what was, you know, what's important to know now is that, well, understand is that, first of all, my grandparents were always involved in, have been involved for a long time in fighting for reparations for Black people, right?
Right.
So what's happened recently, and I don't know if you're following the H.R. 40 bill and what's happening with reparations now, but there was since the Muslim ban happened after Trump became president, a whole part of the Japanese American community mobilized to support Muslims who were being discriminated against and to support people at the borders, right? People being detained because that was an experience, right? Very familiar to Japanese Americans, all of a sudden losing your rights of citizenship, all of a sudden being detained illegally with no rights, right?
Right.
So they immediately got to action doing that. That was in 2016. Those relationships that have developed and developed and developed to the point that the last couple of years or the last year or two, the Japanese American, this organization called Sudo for Solidarity, that's really organizing all of this work, has mobilized a huge part of the Japanese American community to write testimonials and submit testimonials in support of H.R. 40. And actually, Japanese Americans actually gave testimonial in February at the hearings for H.R. 40 in support of reparations. So I tell this very long story to give an example of how, you know, you could really be in solidarity and use experiences and some success around reparations, you know, to support another group of people, right? And I think that's really important that's happening right now. And those hearings just happened in February. No one's talking about this. They're talking about all this Black Asian violence, but not the fact that so many Japanese Americans are involved with supporting reparations.
Right. But I think, as you said, Akimi, earlier, it doesn't fit the narrative. You know, people coming together and doing this, which in many circles would be considered radical, you know, talking about reparations, you know, nah, that's not what Asian folks do. Let's write that off and let's show, you know, something that would be a little bit more salacious and disturbing, you know, if you will. So I appreciate you sharing that. I want to ask both you and Zulu, our guest this afternoon, part of the question that I was asking was the relationship with your grandmother and Malcolm. Most of us came to know of her from the famous pictures after the assassination with Malcolm being cradled in her hand. And people were like, who's the Japanese lady, you know, that's holding him? But there was a friendship prior to that. Can you talk about that? And what should we glean from that, from that friendship that has forever kind of linked the two together?
I think Well, what happened was my grandmother was at in Brooklyn at the courts, and you know, she that's when she first met Malcolm. He was sort of surrounded by a crowd of people. Of course, he was obviously super famous at the time, and she you know, mustered up the courage to shake his hand, to meet him, and she said something like, I want to thank you, or something. He said, thank me for what? And she said, you know, thank you for what you're doing for your people. And he said, what am I doing for my people? And she, you know, she just had the courage to sort of like, you know, muster up that conversation. And then she said something like, you know, I don't agree with everything you say, you know, in terms of integration. And he was like, you know, I can't talk about that now, but, you know, get into it now, but here's my card. And they kind of, you know, made that connection there. And then they got to know each other. And then she became one of the members of the OA, OAAU,
right.
Like a card carrying member. So, and then when he traveled to Africa, he wrote, you know, he wrote postcards. I think it was like 11 postcards to her and the family, you know, throughout his trips. You know, which was, you know, also, you know, pretty amazing. He told her he would write them and was true to his word. And then of course, Akimi can talk about the visit, you know, him visiting the famous visit, at Manhattanville Projects where my grandparents lived. Akimi, you could talk about
I'll tell that story. And I think what's really important to think about their friendship is that they really, you know, Yuri would really learn so much from him and was really, you know, kind of, you know, said it just, he was able to teach her so much about how to, about her own political philosophy, right? And connect all these dots. And I think what was so beautiful about it, you know, like Zulu said, when she first met him, she was very much a civil rights activist when she met him and very sort of pro-integration, because that's, right. You know, what this, you know, the focus of civil rights was at that time. And, you know, she said, you know, so crazy that she told him that she disagreed with his perspective on that at the time. And he was willing to engage with her on it, you know, which is mm-hmm. one, I think, says a lot about Malcolm, that he was willing to talk to her about it. But that over time, you know, she actually became a really radical Black nationalist, you know. And so by the time, you know, Malcolm passes, and, you know, she emerged with that very radical Black nationalist movement. And, you know, Malcolm over time became more and more of an internationalist, right?
Right.
And you know, and also, you know, shifted his thinking. And I think that they both, you know, really influenced each other in a lot of ways, you know, that were really interesting. But in terms of, yeah, I think it's important for people to know, I think, you know, Malcolm came to our grandparents' house in the Manhattanville Projects in 1964. And I think it's really important to know why he came and what he came for. And it was, you know, she had been talking to him, was a member of the OAAU, and then this group, the Hiroshima Nagasaki Peace Study Mission. It was a international peace study tour, and it was being led by some Japanese reporters and anti-war writers who were traveling with a group of hibakusha, who are atomic bomb victims. So they had bomb victims with them. And they were making this international tour, and they came to New York, and more than anyone else, they wanted to meet Malcolm X. They were most interested in meeting Malcolm X. So
she
invited Malcolm to come, but she wasn't sure if he was going to come because he was, you know, he was at that time, you know, they had already issued a warning that they were going to, you know, murder him. And, you know, he was like very much.
He had a falling out by this time.
He had this falling out. Yeah. Right. So he had fallen out with the nation. It was very much under, you know, a lot of high security. So he came, actually ended up coming, and I think they had a house full of 40 or 50 guests. You know, people from the Harlem Parents Committee helped put together the event, and then they had all these reporters and writers. And, you know, they said Malcolm talked that night mostly about Vietnam, and this was 1964. Right.
Wow.
So he really understood the context, right, of these people being here and what was happening. And he talked about imperialism. Right. That's what he talked about, because that's what, you know, the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki was about, and what Vietnam was about. And he said, apparently, very famously that night, he said, the war that the people of Vietnam are struggling is the war of the third world, right? It's a war against imperialism and neocolonialism, and that all people of color should be in solidarity with the Vietnamese, right? And he said this in, he talked very highly of Ho Chi Minh. This is in, 1964. And so this is before, he went, and he, I think it's really important that he saw those connections and the solidarity then he was talking about it at that moment, right? It also shows, how far ahead he was, but also how dangerous he was, right? To, the powers that be. So I think that it's profound, how much he understood the connections between what happened in the third world, all over the country. I mean, all over the world.
You know, the Bendong conference that was held, I guess, what was it, 1955 in Indonesia. How much of that influenced either your grandmother, Yuri, or your understanding with Malcolm in terms of, looking at things from an international perspective, and in particular, recognizing the Asian diaspora and vice versa?
I'm not really sure about that particular one, but like to Akemi's point, I think just my grandmother's outlook was always sort of connecting the dots in terms of international scope, in terms of people's struggles. I mean, like I said before, whether it was, liberating Puerto Rico, or obviously apartheid during that time, or Peru. I mean, she was always thinking, in terms of third world struggle.
Right.
And I'm guessing that is definitely something that she learned from Malcolm.
Right.
Yeah, I think the Bendong conference, I think, Malcolm was very inspired by all of that happening, and him going to Africa and being able to meet with leaders and understand the kind of connections that they were making across with leaders from Asia and different places was very exciting to him, and he could see the possibilities of that and that what had been happening and that had happened at that conference. I think he was very excited about that. And excited, he was talking so much about that as he came writing about all this kind of solidarity, he was seeing solidarity on many different levels after he went to Africa.
We're running out of time, so I want to do a couple of things. One, as we celebrate the 100th birthday of your grandmother, Yuri Kochiami, the 96th birthday of Malcolm X, and forget Lorraine Hansberry, and Ho Chi Minh's birthday is saying, wow, so there's a lot of birthdays. Taurus in the building, right? Mm-hmm. It is Taurus, right? Yeah, it's Taurus.
Correct, yeah.
May 10th, I'm a Taurus, so we're all in the same same plane.
Me too.
Oh, there you go. What sort of things do you all have planned? Films, documentaries? Can you talk a little bit about the archives? How can we get more information as we are, looking back at some of this history, especially during AAPI month and definitely, looking at Malcolm?
So a couple of things. I would mention a couple of films that are out already that anybody could watch that we've been reminded in the last couple of weeks are really important. One is Passion for Justice, which is a documentary that Third World Newsreel did many years ago in the 90s about Yuri's work. And it's really good. It's a less than an hour. It's actually good sort of to show as an educational piece, like for a class or something like that.
Was that also her book too? The same title?
Yeah, it has the same title.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And then there's also, yeah, so that's also a good resource, her memoir. But I think Passion for Justice is a good film. Also, the one When Mountains
Take Wing. Oh, no.
When Mountains Take Wing is a great documentary about Yuri and Angela Davis. And these filmmakers amazingly track them for like over 20 years and interviewed them numerous times together talking about international, just talking about politics, about, civil rights, about everything. So it's actually a very good film. That's a really good one that I think is just a good resource. So the other thing is that in the next couple of days, some videos are going to be dropping. So Zulu, do you know the name of the project that Renee Tajima is doing? We know a bunch of filmmakers are dropping, they've made 14 mini docs on Black Asian solidarity. Yeah. So they're gonna start dropping, Renee is working on this project. So they're gonna start dropping May 19th. There's gonna be a video every day from May 19th to June 1st. So I'm
okay, hold on 1 second. Let me just have you do this. I'm gonna edit it so we can have the continuity. Yeah, so that's what I was talking about, the 14 videos. Do you have the name? Then I'll just have you just repeat that so we can.
I don't have the name. Do you, okay. Azula, do you? I don't know the name of the project. I know who's the main director is Renee Tajima, but I don't know. She's working with a ton of people and they haven't. Right. Have they told us what it's called? We did. We worked on the first one because the first one is about Malcolm and Yuri. And Zulu and I just did that a couple weeks ago. But there's 13 other videos.
Okay, let me just. I'll edit it and I'll just ask you the questions to lead into that. So give me a second. 3, 2, 1. All right. So we have these two documentaries: Passing for Justice and When Mountains Take Wings with Yuri and Angela Davis. You were just saying off air, Akimi, that they're going to be 14 documentaries that drop to really underscore the importance of Black and Asian solidarity. Can you talk about the ones that you worked on? You know, because
the first one is going to be about Yuri and Malcolm. I think these are small, you know, short mini docs. I think they're like 3 or 4 minutes or something. And the first one is about Yuri and Malcolm, and it's going to drop on May 19th. Birthdays, and then there'll be one every day until June 1st.
Is there a place where we can see them? Is it going to be online and on all the different platforms?
It is. I just don't know where to direct you yet. The director just sent us an email tonight, but Zulu, I don't know if you can see anything from what she sent you. She didn't tell us where it's going to be.
The other thing that happened just recently was there's this mural on 125th Street. It's very, very close to Manhattanville. It's like a stone's throw away from Manhattanville, and it's a mural that is dedicated to Yuri and Malcolm and their solidarity. So that was just retouched. Originally, it was painted back in 2016. Mm-hmm. Sophia Dawson was one of the artists, and then. It was organized so that the community came out. So kids in the community, people in the community came out and helped to paint it. And it was organized by a bunch of young people. So many names, you know, Akimi, of course, was involved with it. Christina Pang and Sean Lin and Francis Perez. I mean, it was a lot of people, Luke Peterson and Patterson. So, that was just, we just retouched that and restored that. So that was done, and that will also be in the documentaries.
Yeah, so there's gonna be a big press conference on May 19th at 12:30 at the Wall. So part of it was, you know, Zulu really helped to do the retouching so that, you know, it had just in the last couple of years needed some repair because there's gonna be all these videos, but also because we're having a press release and a call for Black, Brown, Asian solidarity on May 19th at the Wall. So a bunch of different organizations that we've all been sort of working together trying to figure out how do we best show the long history, like this, not just like Black Asian solidarity now, and that it's not just Black Asian, right? It involves, you know, many other people and groups and communities. So I'll name some of the organizations involved, from Black Panther Party to Zulu Nation to Asian American Women's Workshop to Black Women Radicals to the Yuri Koshyama Malcolm X Mural Project. The People's Church, so many organizations are involved in this moment, and we're going to have a press conference and a few speakers there, including Jamal Joseph from the BPP. And then we're going to join the December 12th group, and they do a march across 125th Street every May 19th. So we're joining that group, and they're going to go to, you know, finish their regular commemoration. So our sort of group will join them on May 19th on 125th Street. So that's to really show, you know, we're really just trying to, you know, people felt like we had to do something in person, not just virtually, right?
Right.
To show that there's a long history of this, and this is not new. This solidarity.
And it ain't a one-off.
Y'all
been doing this, real talk. You know, Akimi, thank you very much for joining us. Zulu, thank you very much. We've been talking with the grandchildren of Yuri Koshyama, getting ready to celebrate her 100th birthday, also the 100th birthday of Malcolm X. I wouldn't say it's the 100th birthday of Lorraine Hansberry, but they share the same birthday, and Ho Chi Minh as well. So there you have it. We are going to take a break. here on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Even if them kids cop the shirts and start wearing them, humbled in the presence of the veterans and not the ones who picked up their guns, but who picked up their brethren and sisterin. History in the making, I was witnessing, listening. Seen this old Japanese lady with a sticker on her walker said, "Free Mumia." And this was before the Trustafarians were saying it, taking it for granted that we talk about the 60s and never get to talk to anybody who done lived the shit and still exists. Or better yet, she still resists speaking to a myriad of young, dumb and ignorant kids. I was one of them, stuck around lingering. Said that it's a privilege to meet you in person, and she took my hand, said it's good to meet you too. And when I'm out of school, ask me what I'm gonna do. I had to think about it, but truth is I knew that it was something for the youth and shit. Truly, I'd probably be a teacher if the music didn't make enough to make me wanna gamble on its sustenance. And that's why I'm writing this, to tell y'all, from a scholar, when I grow up I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama. Holla, swear to my kasamas, when I grow up I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama. And if she ever hear this, it's an honor, cause when I grow up I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama. Tama, serve the people proper, and when I grow up I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama. Seen a picture up in Life magazine, you were sitting front seat for Malcolm's last speech. Saw the first man with the shotgun, two more came to get the job done. Now who would have thought that it'd be you holding him? I wonder what you felt when his eyes were going dim. And if he never died, would we know that he exists? Or would he been the leader that we always seem to miss? Now there's no taking back whatever happens in our midst. You remind me that it's more than just a martyr and a myth. You could have said it quits many times ever since, and you find there will always be a reason for the fist. The last one to hold him could have been somebody else. You'd still be remembered for the people that you helped. They said to keep trying, but never losing hope. Revolutionaries die, but the revolution don't, and it won't. And I put that on my mama, cause when I grow up I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama. Holla, swear to my kasamas, when I grow up I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama. And if she ever hear this, it's an honor, cause when I grow up I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama. Comma, serve the people proper, when I grow up I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama.
If I don't see a change, then there's flowers to your people and your body being viewed. 7 hours in the steeple. What a change for my people, a change for my people. I put my fist in the air, yo. Power to the people. If I don't see a change, then there's flowers to your people and your body being viewed. 7 hours in the steeple. What a change for my people. Look, I'm a product of my grandma's hands. Ain't no sunshine, we close blinds and remember rest of my friend. Little man finally copped him a plan. Why you stuck on that pipe dream of pushing the land? Reminiscing on my past life, fast life, I was a trip. Slaying navigators on slave ships, dropping dimes on overseas who try to beat us. I believe I can fly, but they never teach us. I guess we was just the wrong brothers, so they accredited the right brothers. Analyze my blueprint and now we first in flight. My life is like a history book, now study. Your life is like a mystery book, it's blurry. What is your aim? Where is your plot? You got clientele, where is your block? Every day, all day, things don't change and under the sun. Every night I put the Holy Bible under my son, praying that the day he grows up a change gon' come. Reparation for my people, but it ain't gon' come. Reparation for my people, but it ain't gon' come.
Reparation for my people, but it ain't gonna come. I put my fist in the air, yell, power to the people. If I don't see a change, then it's flowers to your people and your body being viewed. Several hours in the steeple, want a change for my people, a change for my people. I put my fist in the air, yell, power to the people. If I don't see a change, then it's flowers to your people and your body being viewed. Several hours in the steeple, want a change for my people, a change for my people. I put my fist.
When you live in a poor neighborhood, you're living in an area where you have to have poor schools. When you have poor schools, you have poor teachers. When you have poor teachers, you get a poor education. Poor education can only work on a poor paying job. And that poor paying job enables you to live again in a poor neighborhood.
Listen, I want some change for my people. I need some change for my people. I want some change for my people. Listen, come on. Listen, it's like one nation, one God, indivisible. They treat me like I'm invisible, nigga. They never acknowledge my work in college. I work to be an equal, so I gotta spit political. And most affirmative acts, I'd rather hit you with affirmative gas. Twin glocks like Rames and Rosewood. My origin so hood, thank God I flow good. Now I got something to fall back on. Thinking back in my teen years, I was real shocked at cops. How they infiltrated our spot and took over blocks. How they smacked us in the face with the back of their hand, aiming to make us feel less than a man. This ain't a cop killer rendition. Right. I'm just holding my position as a man, use a hood intuition. My people in the hood can't afford tuition. My people in the hood won't fight. They get bored with bitching. So I gotta work three times harder. Being 33 and a third of a man made me work much harder. I was born in the era of Carter. Born in Reagan, blood and Crips and folk and aces. I was born around the same time that crack would discover. New income for blacks to discover. New setbacks for blacks to discover. Now we got crack babies in the public school systems. And they can't act right. Now I don't know about you, but I don't know one teacher who took the time out for kids with the ghetto features. Either they in school suspension or out of school detention. Or we up with my son while he trying to learn. In a hypothetical situation, what if my son react? Become a victim of that black on black homicide slash genocide. Who is to blame? Point at the government and take aim. I want to change for my people. Fist in the air, yo. Power to the people. If I don't see a change, then it's flowers to your people and your body being used. Several hours in the steeple. Want to change for my people, a change for my people. I put my fist in the air, yo. Power to the people. If I don't see a change, then it's flowers to your people and your body being used. Several hours in the steeple. Want to change for my people, a change for my people.
Being here in America doesn't make you an American. Being born here in America doesn't make you an American. Why, if birth made you American, you wouldn't need any legislation. You wouldn't need any amendments to the Constitution. No, I'm not an American. I'm one of the 22 million black people who are the victims of Americanism. One of the 22 million black people who are the victims of democracy. Nothing but disguised hypocrisy. And I see America through the eyes of a victim. I don't see any American dream. I see an American nightmare.
In the realm of the airwaves, where the truth does spin, takes the mic, let the dialogue begin. From the heart of the culture, where the beasts do sway, hip-hop politics and culture rule the day.
Hard Knock rocking on your radio. Hard Knock rocking on your radio. Hard Knock rocking on your radio. Let's go, let's go.
Daily dose of the real, where the news unfolds. Stories untold in the mainstream's hold. From the streets to the suites, putting fools on blast, breaking chains of silence.